Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Good morning. It's 8:30 on Tuesday, March 28th. I'm Desiree Frazier. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. On today's show, as the legislative session enters its final week, some lawmakers hope to secure financial relief for communities devastated by last week's tornadoes. And one conference report passed by both chambers could open the door for armed teachers in Mississippi classrooms. Then an exhibit in Jackson tells the stories of African-American midwives in the South. Plus, how a recent hard freeze could be giving some commercial fruit farmers the blues. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. Lawmakers are hoping to move quickly to get some funding to the counties ravaged by storms before the legislative session ends. Destructive storms and at least one tornado ripped a path 100 miles long across Mississippi late Friday night. At least 25 people are dead and a number of communities are devastated. Federal dollars have already been promised by the Biden administration through a major disaster declaration. But House Democrat John Hines, of Greenville, tells our Lacey Alexander he hopes something can be done on the state level by the end of the session.
I have a part of South Delta School District, as part of the district in which I represent, and I had a couple of friends who lost their lives in this storm, and I'm torn. You know, the Lord works in mysterious ways, and sometimes tragedy like this pull communities together. But what I've saw is a level of love and resiliency in the two communities. I know people in Silver City as well as Rolling Fork, and so I'm just kind of, you know, roller coaster ride emotion. It's just amazing. We have people who've been calling from, you know, central Mississippi, the other side of Mississippi, who wants to do stuff. Classmates of mine who have live in Texas and Florida sending money and stuff. So it's just a, you know, just roller coaster. You know, you spend 1 minute crying and the next minute you rejoice because, you know, you just don't even think about how people come together in tragedy like this. I hope we can learn that regardless of where we're from, or how we live our lives or earn our money, that we can come together and work and make Mississippi better. I think God allows this situations like this to happen to remind people that we're all human and we have a better purpose than what we've been serving while we're in elected positions and leadership roles. I think we have to be mindful of those kind of things.
What is legislation at the state level doing to help your community right now?
Well, actually, they're supposed to be bringing some, before we leave, we're supposed to be voting on some funding, emergency management funding. We don't actually know what the numbers is. It first started out at 5, then went up to 8. Some people think it's going to be 15 to 20. I'm more in the range of maybe $80 to $100 million worth of damage overall in that community because Rolling Fork is completely wiped out, Silver City. But when you look from end to end, the ticket possibly should at least be $80 to $100 million. But, you know, we just don't know how much the federal government is going to bring and how much the state will be responsible for. But the conversations I had with the speaker have been very, very refreshing. And when he first got elected, he had part of that area in his district. So, it's, you know, I think we're just in a good place for finding some resolve in this situation.
We were in Rolling Fork yesterday, mm-hmm. and a lot of these people...
I was there all morning.
Lot of people said, talking about housing, I don't want to leave my community. This is my home. I don't want to be placed somewhere far away. What about that area is so important to those residents?
It's home. Home is where your heart is. I've been fortunate enough to live in Greenville all my life, with the exception of going off to college and the military. that's where the root, your roots are. And people in Mississippi, we're cornbread and greens and beans. You know, we basically want to be around our family, our friends. When your parents kind of age out, you want to be close to them so nothing happens to them. And then as they age out, you become the aged. And so, you know, it's a cycle of legacy and history that a small community like that, for lack of better words, Mayberry, you know. Everybody wants, in Mississippi, tries to give everyone that Mayberry feeling. And so we're grateful that people want to stay. They don't want to run away. And because that's a area that's rich with legacy and history. And so we want to restore it and make it, you know, make it the pulse of the Delta that it once was.
Representative, thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That's Representative John Hines of Greenville with our Lacey Alexander. After a weekend of deliberations, lawmakers are approving final conference reports this week. Yesterday, both chambers passed the Mississippi School Protection Act. It would allow school districts to opt into a program that will train and permit school personnel to conceal carry guns on campus. Known as the Guardians Program, the measure also provides immunity to participants under certain circumstances. Republican Nick Bain of Corinth presented the bill on the House floor yesterday. He was questioned about those immunity provisions by Democrat Bryant Clark of Pickens.
The scope and purpose of each program shall include responding to an active shooter situation or other situation that would cause death or serious bodily harm. That's another change that we made in conference. We added the word serious. Before, it just said bodily harm. I had some issue with that because that was kind of mean. You could potentially say somebody breaking up a fight could cause bodily harm. But serious bodily harm on the school campus or in the immediate vicinity of the school.
And then also I noticed that it just simply say immunity. You got two types of immunity. You have criminal immunity as well as civil immunity.
The criminal is in the bill as well. They can be justified and have an affirmative defense. Section 3 brings that in there. Line 291, when necessarily committed in performance of duty as a member of a school safety guardian program. So your criminal liability when it comes to a school guardian is should be covered.
So they will have criminal liability as well.
They could have immunity, yes.
Yeah, criminal immunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and an affirmative defense.
Opponents of the bill, like Democrat Jeffrey Hullum of Gulfport, wonder why the measure didn't specify which types of firearms would be permissible for those enrolled in the program.
I read this bill two times, so I'm trying to figure out what is the type of firearms that would be allowed for these guardians to carry?
It doesn't limit that. It doesn't say any type of firearm, I don't believe, unless these statutes, which I did not make any type of note as to that. And these statutes would talk about, like Section 45901 with an endorsement title, unless those limit what type of gun can be carried. There's no specificity in the bill that does so.
Because I truly think we're going down a slippery slope if we do not put the type of firearm in that must be carried. Because you can take an assault rifle that with a short barrel is considered a pistol, not a long gun. So you may have a teacher or administrator in this guardian program saying that they want to take that or they want a .357 Magnum. You know, you're only supposed to use the necessary equipment to neutralize or detain a situation. So have we thought about that?
The measure ultimately passed the House 79-32, with 10 either not voting or voting present. During debate, Democrat Chef Taylor of Starkville questioned the possible unintended consequences of the legislation.
I will submit to you that this bill may be well-intentioned, but the ramifications of a person with very little training walking to a school setting with a classroom that's probably overcrowded, with maybe a behavioral problem here and there, that the conversation may end up in a lethal situation without an active shooter being involved.
The Senate voted 38-14 in favor of the conference report. Representative Nick Bain says no school is compelled to participate and that districts may decide if, who, and how many guardians it would enlist. Coming up, an exhibit in Jackson tells the stories of African-American midwives in the South. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Hello, I'm Dr. Nancy Lottridge Anderson, president of New Perspectives, a fee-only financial advising firm and co-host of Money Talks. For over 10 years, Money Talks has been answering your personal financial questions and sharing knowledge about money management. Money Talks can be heard Tuesdays at 9 a.m. on MPB Think Radio. Podcasts can be found on our website, money.mpbonline.org, or on your smart device's podcasting platform.
Classical, jazz, indie, blues, folk, bluegrass, whatever you call your music. Find it on MPB Music Radio, on mpbonline.org, or the MPB Public Media app, or on an HD radio.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. African-American midwives, also known as granny midwives, were some of the first to make the practice of midwifery prominent in the South. From the Gulf States newsroom, Maya Miller heads to a new permanent installation in Jackson that shares their story.
From Florida, Aurelia Hardin has arrived at a museum in Jackson, Mississippi. She's not alone. She's with her mother and teenage daughter. They're in town for a show choir competition, but on a slow Saturday in February, they're here to learn about midwives.
How it was, like, remember when Grandma was working at the hospital? That kind of looks like how it was then.
The three women are standing in a room with an iron double bed made with starch white linens. At the foot of the bed is a worn leather bag, and nearby on a stool rests a kettle large enough to bathe a newborn baby.
This probably was the hot water. Yeah.
This is a permanent exhibit on Mississippi's granny midwives at the Smith Robertson Museum and Cultural Center in downtown Jackson. The Hardins, who are Black, pause at every section of the exhibit, including one that tells the story of how the first midwives, who were enslaved women, were brought to America from West Africa. On a small table, there are cotton bundles along with miniature versions of farming equipment, reinforcing how, even through back-breaking manual labor, someone still needed to deliver babies. Aurelia's mother, Marilyn, who is 65, tells family stories.
My grandfather, he was a sharecropper, and they had cotton, and they also had tobacco, but this is what cotton looked like.
And then the family gathers closer to the glass that protects midwifery manuals and birth certificates from the 1930s.
Either mine or my parents, they have the word color.
Marilyn remembers what it was like to work in the fields during the summer. She also remembers stories of women delivering babies in those same fields.
You wouldn't expect the farmer to come out, but a lot of times we did, had to deliver a baby if the midwife didn't show up. The grandparents or somebody had to deliver them in the field.
Both Marilyn and Aurelia are educators in Florida, and the state has come down hard against teaching race or African-American history, especially in the past year. As she looked over the midwifery exhibit, Marilyn said it is vital to seek out Black history.
Make sure, because a Black history, they don't want you to don't even teach Black history. They want to infuse it. They want to teach that other history, somebody else's history. But they don't want you to know your history or take a class in it.
This museum is a small part of the deeper history of this area of Jackson. It's just a few blocks over from Ferris Street, which was once the Black epicenter of the city.
You know the history of Ferris Street. If you say Ferris Street, it's like saying Bill Street or Bourbon Street.
That's Gwen Harmon. She's the manager and curator for educational exhibits at the museum.
It's all Black. It's Black cultural. It's Black historical. Ferris Street used to be the hub of African-American physicians, pharmacies, retailers, restaurants.
Jim Crow South, most hospitals would not accept Black patients. Black women, and sometimes poor white women, would call on the midwives to deliver their babies at home. But by the mid-20th century, granny midwives were being edged out of the practice.
There are other entities that come before who find that maybe that's an encroachment on what they have been doing. Pretty much the majority white medical profession.
because they started putting a lot of limitations on the midwives.
Those limitations included the ability to prescribe medicines, courses they took, how to keep patient records, and even what the midwives wore.
What they were hoping for was that it would reduce Black women becoming midwives, and it did have an impact on that number. The numbers did start to drop, as you can imagine.
And so did the communities around Ferris Street. But now there are efforts to preserve the area. And she encourages others to search their family archives and attics for artifacts of what their ancestors accomplished, to share those stories with future generations.
It's a wealth of knowledge. Look at your museums and go and see about donating those items and creating an exhibit of some sort so that the world can understand how important it was.
For the Gulf States Newsroom, I'm Maya Miller.
The Gulf States Newsroom is a collaboration between Mississippi Public Broadcasting and public media stations in Louisiana and Alabama. Coming up, how a recent hard freeze could be giving some commercial fruit farmers the blues. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Hi, I'm Richard Gershon, the host of In Legal Terms and a professor at the University of Mississippi School of Law. If you miss a live In Legal Terms episode, find our podcast, inlegalterms.mpbonline.org.
This podcast is a local production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting. It's made possible in part by contributions from podcast listeners. Please consider making a contribution by going to the Donate Now tab at mpbonline.org. Thanks for your financial support.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. Blueberries, they're the state's largest commercial fruit crop with up to 2,000 acres of production each year. But Mississippi blueberry producers can expect to see substantial yield losses following a recent hard freeze. Eric Stephanie is a fruit and nut specialist with the Mississippi State University Extension Service. He explains more with our Michael Guidry.
The most of the production is about in the southern part of state, maybe south of I-20. But there's, you know, roughly 1,000 to 2,000 acres at any time that's harvested for commercial type production. But there's also other varying levels of production. People use it for local markets, you know, home use, pick your own, all those sort of things. So, those are also agritourism type activities that people are used to participating in. And so it's very popular. And Mississippi is a pretty good place to grow blueberries because of the soils that we have here, especially in the Pine Belt area, South Mississippi. The soils are acidic, so it's very good for blueberries, and we have lots of native blueberry bushes that grow wild here, and so a lot of the varieties that we grow are just, you know, bred from wild bushes at one period in time, and so they're not that far removed from that genetic base, so, they're well adapted here.
We had an uncharacteristic, you know, to late March freeze, and that has potentially caused a kind of a disruption in blueberry harvest, blueberry production. How uncharacteristic is a freeze like that, and how does it interrupt, you know, the plant's life cycle when it comes to producing, you know, lots of fruit during those early summer harvest months?
Right. So the freeze event that we had around March 20th was really devastating for a number of reasons. One, because it got very cold. It got colder than usual this late in the season. And the other contributing factor was February was so warm that the bloom and the fruit development was ahead of schedule. So in a year where we, you know, it might be normal to get potentially a frost event this at that time of the year. The plants usually aren't that far along. It doesn't get quite as cold as it did. And we see maybe some effect, but not as devastating effect as we had this time. So when you get down to 24, 25 degrees, and the fruit is already set on the bush, that destroys the fruit. It also kills any flowers that are open at that time. And there's not a lot you can do to protect it, unfortunately. You know, our industry, even though we have 1,000 acres or more, it's still pretty small. Most of our farms are very small, and they don't have the infrastructure to protect against a freeze event like that.
So that's a great explanation of how that freeze kind of interrupted the life cycle and what it does to the plant. Now on the other side of it, the farmers, whether they be commercial farmers, small, you know, farmers market farmers, or some of the agritourism, like you mentioned, the you know, come pick your own that attracts people. What is this going to do to their bottom line?
Yeah, I think for commercial growers who sell to wholesalers and that sort of thing, it's really devastating because you're wiping out maybe 50%, maybe 75%, 80%. It's still a little early to know the exact amount, but for some, it's almost a complete loss. So they have nothing to sell. Or if there is anything still out there in the field, it may not be you know, economically viable to go and harvest it. You know, and another factor into this is the availability of labor. So, you know, if you have a large farm and you're bringing in workers to harvest fruit, and there's not much fruit, then you're not going to need all those workers to come in. And so it's really devastating for them. Now, for something like a pick-your-own or, you know, some maybe local market, there probably will still be some fruit, though it's going to be not as much fruit. So, you know, that just the volumes won't be there this year.
And so what could that do for the market price of blueberries this season? I mean, should people who frequent farmers markets, because of what you just said, expect a little bit of a higher price? And is Mississippi enough of a commodity producer or a blueberry producer nationally that it'll affect, you know, sales or some market prices on a larger scale?
Yeah, it's probably not very much going to change the prices a lot. There might be some change in local markets where there's a you know, not very much fruit, so the price might be a little bit higher. On a national scale, Mississippi's not a huge player, so that's not going to really affect things very much. Maybe a little bit on certain markets that might get some Mississippi fruit, but globally and nationally, there's a lot of blueberries out there. And so it's probably not going to affect things that way very much.
Eric Staffney is a professor of fruit crops at the Mississippi State University Extension Service. Eric, thank you so much for taking some time to talk to us about blueberry production and the effect this recent freeze has had on our blueberry farmers.
You're very welcome.
This has been Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.